Hi, welcome back to the Incidental Economist Podcast. Today's date is October 7th, 2011. I'm Aaron Carroll.
And I'm Austin Fracht.
And today we're going to be talking about the individual mandate and why it's in healthcare reform, what it has to do with the Affordable Care Act, and why so many of the court challenges have been focused on it. This is one of those issues that I've been interested in for quite some time, because even back in the Democratic primary, which, oh my God, what was that, 4 years ago now?
Yeah.
This was one of the big arguments between then-candidate Obama and then-candidate Hillary Clinton, because her health care proposal actually had an individual mandate, and his did not. And I remember quite clearly that he kept attacking her for that.
Right, yeah. I don't know whether at the time he was making that decision to not have a mandate purely for political reasons or just to differentiate himself, or whether he didn't yet understand the role it plays and why it became necessary to include it in his health reform plan.
Yeah, and it's. I remember quite clearly reading a number of columns by Paul Krugman, who kept arguing that he was shooting himself in the foot, that you would need a mandate in order to make all of this work along the lines of what they were saying. And that I remember quite clearly again, President, or then Senator Obama, saying again and again that, well, if we just make it cheap enough, then everyone will buy it and you won't need a mandate, which is, of course, now the argument that people will try to make again if they manage to get the individual mandate repealed.
Yeah, well, at some level, that's true. If it was free, everybody would do it. Or, you know, if it was basically single payer, where it just, you know, you just walk into the healthcare facility and it's covered, you don't even think about insurance, then it's true. But if you're going to have to pay a premium, then people have a choice, and they're going to weigh, in some sense, the cost benefits of that to them. And some people will choose not to take up insurance. And that's where you start to see, when you think that through, you start to see why the mandate is necessary.
Well, let's actually talk about that, because I think that, you know, it's so unpopular and it's been so reviled even before the law was passed. I think a number of people just don't understand why we need it at all. And so let's actually talk about that for a bit. It's important to remember that what people really wanted out of healthcare reform were a few key regulatory changes. The first is that people wanted to know that they would always be able to buy insurance, that insurance companies could not refuse them. Because these days, if you don't get insurance through your job and you have to buy it on the individual market, when you try to get insurance, someone actually will often come to your house, do some blood tests, do an exam, take a full physical and medical history. And if you're not in really good health, if something is wrong, they will refuse to insure you. Because, of course, if you have a disease that they know is going to cost a reasonable or significant amount of money in the future, they don't want to have to pay for that. And if it's a guarantee, they will refuse to give you insurance.
Actually, so there's two things that can happen. You just talked about guaranteed issue. They could refuse, which relates to or does away with the fact that they could refuse to cover you at all. There's also this pre-existing conditions exclusions, which are more focused. So if they find you have, you know, a history of, melanoma or something, they might refuse to cover you for anything related to that, but they'll cover you for everything else.
Yes.
Right.
So you just said the magic words, which is really what everybody wanted. It's guaranteed issue. They want to know that they are going to be able to buy insurance no matter if they have a pre-existing condition, no matter if they're a little bit older, no matter if they live in a bed, it doesn't matter what it is. Everybody wants to know that they're going to be able to buy insurance.
Buy insurance that covers everything. You know.
Yeah, comprehensive insurance. You're right. Yeah. Everyone wants them to know that they can buy comprehensive insurance.
Right.
The second thing that people were really upset about and wanted fixed was the idea that even if you could get the policy, it could be prohibitively expensive. If you have a chronic condition and you somehow manage to convince them to give you a policy, it could cost tens of thousands of dollars a year. If you happen to be older, the same thing would occur. My parents were both retired, and in their late 60s, early 60s, they both wanted to buy insurance. And I think, if I remember correctly, my dad's insurance policy cost something like $25,000 a year before the $5,000 deductible. Hmm. Now, he was lucky. He was a retired surgeon. He could actually afford that, amazingly enough. But the vast majority of people cannot. And so, you know, to insure my parents was something like $40,000 a year before another $10,000 deductible. They weren't even ill. Wow. But that's what it costs to insure a 61, 62, 63-year-old person. That's very expensive. And so people wanted to know also that if they got a chronic condition that through no fault of their own, or if they just happen to be a bit old, that they would be able to buy insurance, that they couldn't be penalized for something that's not their fault for having a pre-existing condition. And so they want insurance rates to be based sort of through a veil of ignorance, through the idea of like, we just believe that insuring someone should cost this amount. We're going to try to spread it more equally. That's called community ratings. And so that was the second big regulation that was sort of favored by everybody, that that you can make some adjustments, perhaps based on age, but they would be contained, or perhaps based upon whether you smoke or things like that. But in general, that insurance would not be prohibitively expensive based upon individual conditions that would affect you. And both of these things are incredibly popular. Every poll that was done, even polls that continue to be done, that show that 60, 70, sometimes even more percent of Americans support both the idea of guaranteed issue and community ratings. But yeah, there's a problem associated with that.
Yeah, I think no matter what the structure of the health reform plan, whether it is the plan that was passed or whether it was some other proposal that could be radically different in certain ways, they're going to have these components because everybody seems to think that they're important. You know, those are not that controversial.
No, and everybody likes them. But the problem is that if you guarantee that you're going to give everybody health insurance and you also guarantee that they won't pay more if they are sick, you can get into what's called a free rider problem. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So, right, if you don't have a mandate, everybody decides for themselves whether they're going to get insurance. And like I said, they're going to do some kind of, whether they're explicit or not, some kind of cost-benefit analysis. They're going to look at the price tag. They're going to say, well, you know, that's a lot of money. I'm not going to pay for it because I don't really think I'm going to get sick. Or, you know, I didn't get sick last year. I'm healthy. I'm young. Maybe I'm not going to buy it. So that's what relatively younger and healthier people would say, and some of them won't buy the insurance. Conversely, relatively sicker or older people who are more likely to get a disease or a chronic illness will look at the price tag and say, well, yeah, it's a lot of money, but I really need the insurance because I'm 50 now and I could get heart disease and I got to buy insurance. So what that means is that the people who are disproportionately more likely to use healthcare services, more likely to be sick, more likely to have chronic illness, those are the people who are more likely to buy the insurance product. And the people who are healthier and younger are more likely not to. Some of them will, some of them won't, but there's going to be a skew. And it's going to be skewed toward the sicker and older people who buy it. So when you get that type of population enrolled, they have higher healthcare costs on average. And that will drive the premium higher than maybe was advertised. You know, the insurance company will say, well, we advertised for 10 grand, but we got a population that enrolled that actually costs 11 grand to cover on average. So next year we have to raise the premiums to 11 grand. Now the sticker price is higher. Everybody does the same cost benefit calculation again, whether implicit or explicit. And a few more relatively healthier and younger people decide, well, now it's not worth it. The extra $1,000 just put it over the top. So this happens year after year. The price goes up and up slowly, and the relatively healthier and younger people don't enroll gradually, which in turn pushes the price up higher and higher. And you can get this what's called a death spiral, where the premium just starts to creep up and up and up, and it just gets so high that you just have, you know, the few percent of the most costly people on the plan, and now the health plan costs, you know, $50,000 a year. You know, eventually it can just walk off to infinity. But before it does that, obviously the plan will just be canceled. You know, just say the insurance company will say, we can't offer this product. It's untenable. We cannot. It's just an unstable market. So that's the problem. It's not just a theoretical problem. It's been documented in a couple of instances, but most often it doesn't get to that point. Most often health insurers are smart about this, and they change the plan or they cancel the plan. And that's sort of an implicit death spiral. You know, before it gets bad enough, they just stop offering it. So right. That's what we want to avoid.
Right. So basically the individual mandate was a way to try to strongly encourage people not to try to free ride or to get into the system even while they're healthy. Right. But that's the way that they chose to do it. And it wasn't that there weren't other options. I mean, there's lots of ways to encourage people.
Well, we didn't actually say what the way is. It's, you know, this word mandate gets bandied about, but it's, there's no such thing as a mandate. No, nobody can make anybody do anything. What it is you either buy coverage, creditable coverage, or you pay a tax penalty. And right. So it's not so much a mandate in the sense of, you know, someone compelling you to do it. It's a penalty if you don't. And in fact, it's a modest penalty. It's quite a bit cheaper to pay the penalty than buy insurance. So if you think it's not worth it to you, you know, pay the small penalty. And, you know, no one's going to come knock on your door and berate you about it. You're just going to have to pay a penalty.
Yes, and so that is what it is. But it was the idea that we're going to penalize you if you don't buy the insurance. They're calling it a mandate. You know, it's been bandied about that they'll put you in jail, but that's not going to occur. The IRS can't even theoretically even come after you very hard.
No, while it's through the tax system, a lot of the rules about non-payment of tax don't even apply to this tax. So, you know, not that I would endorse it, but you know, you could just not pay it, and not a lot of bad things are going to happen to you. It's a very weak quote mandate.
Okay, but we should be clear that's what the government did. Is the government is strongly trying to encourage you through a small finance rope, a modest financial penalty, to buy something.
Yep.
That is not unheard of in the United States tax code. The United States often tries to strongly encourage us to do things, usually by providing us incentives on the other end. So it's in the best interest of the United States, or so they believe, for people to buy houses. That theoretically is why they give us a mortgage tax deduction, because if you buy a house, you get money back.
Invest in retirement plans, you get tax-deferred benefits.
Yeah. Have kids, get a child tax credit. There's lots of things that the government tries to do, and they absolutely could have done that with the insurance. They could have just basically modestly raised everybody's taxes $500, $600,
and
then given everybody who got insurance a equal tax credit to give it back. And that would have had theoretically the same effect, and it would have been the same monetary amounts in and out, so it would have been the exact same budgetarily wise. But the implications of saying they were going to increase everybody's taxes was so unpalatable that they went the other route. They didn't actually want anyone to be able to attack it by saying, we're going to raise your taxes, even if we were going to return the money to you. And so they chickened out and they didn't go that route. There are other ways to do it as well. They could have had an open enrollment period. We've discussed some of these things in the blog before.
I actually think they are going to have that anyway. There are going to be annual open enrollment periods.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. There you go.
But they could have done a late enrollment penalty, which exists in Medicare now.
So basically what the both of those are is to say you can only buy insurance in a window, say a month of the year. So people might be less likely to gamble because they could get sick in, let's say it was January. If they get sick in March, they're going to be responsible for 9 months of insurance or health payments until they can get insurance the next January. They may be less likely to gamble, so therefore fewer people would try to game the system. With the penalty, what happens is you say, if you don't buy insurance on day one, you're going to have to pay significantly more when you do try to buy into the system later. This is something that happens in Medicare right now, and that also would strongly encourage people not to try to game the system because it could cost them a lot more money down the line. And so people would be more likely to buy insurance. All of these things would accomplish the same goal, which is to try to get people not to game the system or free ride and wait until they get sick to buy insurance. And you have to remember that was the ultimate goal of the individual mandate. It was a policy end, not a, you know, means to get there. Nobody loves the mandate. They just wanted to avoid the problem that could occur if people tried to gamble or game the system and then led to some sort of insurance death spiral.
So now the mandate's under attack through the court system and headed to the Supreme Court, about which I know Aaron knows more in detail than I do. Aaron and I have been talking about to what extent that's a principled attack, namely, is there really controversy over the mandate itself, or is there just controversy over what it would mean to take it out of the law? Because it would destroy the health insurance market for the reasons we described, this death spiral. And so people know that taking the mandate out of the law would have dire consequences for the law. And the question is that really what's behind the legal cases and the political motivation, or is it the mandate itself, as some may claim? And actually, just today, I think it was CBS News put up a story. They had an interview with Representative Paul Ryan today, and he made it plain, he just stated as much, that the motivation really isn't because the mandate itself is distasteful, but more what it'll do to the law. He recognizes it'll destroy the law, lead to a death spiral, and he's not willing to consider making changes to the mandate. He just wants to take it out and you know, let the cards fall where they may, chips fall where they may.
Yeah, and you know, again, almost all the court cases have centered around the mandate. It's that people say it's an overreach of the federal government to declare that you must buy something. That some people believe if the government can force you to buy health insurance, well, what can't they force you to do?
Make you
eat
broccoli.
This is a slippery slope.
Yeah,
that's been the good one. Other people say, well, healthcare is incredibly different. That it's somehow special. It's unique. And therefore, even if it's a new power instilled into the federal government, this is not a slippery slope. It's a one-time issue. And there are still other people who will argue, dude, this is just a tax. It's, you know, it's the same thing, whether we penalize you for not buying it or whether we, you know, raise everyone's taxes and then return money to you. If you do buy it, it's the same budgetary goal. It's the same thing. Stop freaking out.
Yeah.
It's not that they're coming to your house and putting a gun in your face and putting you in jail. It's a small or modest financial penalty.
But the niceties of how it's done really matter in law. And this is something I don't appreciate because it drives me crazy. I just hate it. But it really matters what the precise language and mechanism is. And some claim that if they had only used the word tax instead of the word penalty or mandate or whatever the wording is, that all this would have gone away. You know, it would just establish a completely different line of argument and defense. And if that's true, even though it would have all the same consequences, as you said, for budget and for behavior and so forth, it personally just drives me crazy that
yeah.
The whole issue can turn on the phrase, even though the consequences are the same. But, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I just don't appreciate that the way a lawyer would.
Well, Kevin just had a recent thing on the blog where he actually dug deep into, I think it was the president's proposal for the super committee, where embedded in that is actually one line which says that they also, as part of the law that he would like to put forward as a bill, they want to replace the, or maybe it was actually the jobs bill. It was one of the two. But he basically wanted to just replace the word penalty with tax two times in the healthcare reform law.
And that
alone could theoretically eliminate all the problems, because if you just take away the word penalty and put in tax, now it's totally legal.
Well, it drives me crazy.
Right. Well, this is the thing. We know that this is how it's going to go. And so it's going to the Supreme Court, because the Obama administration chose not to appeal to the entire 11th Circuit, because it originally was just a small panel, and go straight to the Supreme Court. So this case will be heard, and it's going to go down one of three ways. It's going to go down that they either completely chuck out the individual mandate and therefore say that the law is gone, or they could say the individual mandate is constitutional and the law stands as it is. Or, and this is sort of the split the baby thing, they could say the individual mandate is unconstitutional and has to come out, but we're going to leave the rest of the law standing. There's precedent for that. The Supreme Court has in the past sliced off individual parts of laws, even without what they call a severability clause in the law. Sometimes when they're expecting a problem, they can specifically put in the law, if you cut out part of this, the rest of it stands. They did not with the Affordable Care Act, another perhaps short-sighted thing. But there is precedent that even without a severability clause, the rest of the law could stand. And in fact, a lot of people think that's the way this may go down, because that will allow the Supreme Court to sort of again split the baby and not look too reactionary in either direction, to say, we agree this is an overreach, but the rest of the law can still stand. There are many ways to fix this. Go ahead. If people truly thought the individual mandate is incredibly repulsive, and just as a principled issue felt that was an overreach of government, I think you'd probably see more people saying in the next breath, but we know we can fix it any other way. Let's try to do that. It's very obvious that they're not. I think Representative Ryan made that very clear in today's report from CBS, that they're just not. This is the wedge that people want to use to bring down the Affordable Care Act. I'm slightly skeptical that that will work. I think that there's a fair chance, although I'm not even sure about that, that the individual mandate may be overturned, but I think it's much more likely that the Supreme Court will not want to wade into the huge amount of politics that would come up in an election year if they completely overturn the law. I think it's pretty likely, and here again I'm making a prediction, that the rest of the law would stand either way.
Can I ask a question to that you may know the answer to, just to help me understand? Is it now a 100% certainty that the Supreme Court will have hearings on it?
I can't imagine. Well, it's going appeal. I mean, theoretically, the justices could decide not to hear it. I think that's almost impossible to happen. I think that at this point that they know that the world is watching, that it's an incredibly important case, that a number of different courts at the lower levels have ruled in opposite directions, and so they know they will have to weigh in. And because of the way the docket works, most people think that by the end of June, this case will be heard.
Be heard, or there'll be a decision?
I think a decision. I mean, the distance between hearing and decision of the Supreme Court is not that long, so okay. I imagine probably by the end of June.
And is there any way that they could make a decision that one of the lower courts have made, which is basically a no-standing decision, just say, look, this may or may not be an issue, but nobody yet has, no harm has been done to anybody yet because none of this is applicable until 2014, so we're going to throw it away now. Come back in 2014 with your issues if you want, but it's not applicable.
That is certainly, that would be along the lines of the law standing as it is today. Go forward and let's see what happens later.
Now, if they were to choose that route, would that come into play before they even had hearings, or would they have hearings and then could they, in theory, say afterwards, say, you know what, you didn't even have any standing here?
I think it's theoretically possible that they could refuse to hear the case based upon that. I don't think that that is terribly likely, given that this is not one of those areas where the justices are all going to agree. Mm-hmm. I think they probably will feel the need to have everybody allowed to have their say, even if it's in a dissenting opinion.
Well, I just know from what I've read that what you're saying is clearly the consensus out there among policy journalists that this hearing will go forward. It will happen in the next 9 months or so, and we will have a decision well before the 2012 elections. So no matter how it comes out, it's going to play a role next summer.
Oh yeah, this will make our next year very busy.
Yes, it's bloggers Full Employment Act kind of thing.
Yeah. Very good. I think it'll be an interesting summer. I think that you're going to hear people start to increase the rhetoric as the Supreme Court gets going. But absolutely, it's going to decide right before the election. And it's absolutely probably going to make this a real issue, certainly in 2012, come the fall when everybody goes out to vote.
All right. Well, we will be following it on the blog.
Well, again, thanks for listening. This has been the Incidental Economist Podcast. I'm Aaron Carroll. This has also been Austin Fracht. And we'll see you next week.